Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 281 of Mazin Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Mazin Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us. The Mets have gone 2-2 since we last spoke. That's, I guess, okay. It's been a weird season, folks. And to talk about that weird season, I am joined by Chris McShane and Allison McCaig to talk about Ahmed Rosario, the rotation, the last four games, and to play an epic game of Would You Rather. You don't want to miss this, trust me. Stay tuned. Well, Chris, Allison, we are, the last time we spoke, we were hoping for a better two series for the Mets, and on one hand, we got it. The Mets split their last two series, both two-game series, and both involving one very fun win and one very maddening loss. So, do you guys feel any better about the team than we did a week ago? Do you feel the same? Do you feel worse? Allison, we'll be gentlemen and let you go first here. What do you think?
I think I feel the same. I think, like, I don't know. I mean, the 12-2 win was certainly wonderful. But kind of like the Homer Bailey game, it was kind of like a case of them beating up on bad pitching. And I don't know how, like, super indicative that is of, like, the team getting a lot better or the offense finally escaping the doldrums, because, you know, the very next day they went back to doing the same thing they had been doing against a better pitcher. So,
but not a, like, an ace caliber pitcher anymore. J-Hap is not who
right.
he used to be.
Sure.
They didn't yeah. get almost blanked by, by Kershaw or something.
Right. Which is troubling.
Yeah. Chris, what about you? How are you feeling?
About the same. I mean, I'm now in a spot that they're 4-1 in games that I've been to.
Mm.
So I'm not really actually superstitious anymore, but I will repeat something that I think I've said on the podcast already. If anyone would like to just hand me tickets as a good luck charm, I'm willing to take the chance. but yeah, no, it's...
I went 10-2 one season.
Damn.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
Was it a bad season?
Yeah, I think it was 2011. So
wow.
It accounted for a fair amount of their wins at home.
Yeah, that,
you
that
still,
is...
like, half their home wins.
Yeah,
that's barely possible.
I think I might have gone to 4 or 5 games on the road that year. So maybe it wasn't all, you know, city wins.
Nice.
But still.
Yeah, I still, the San Diego series is still longer for me in the ledger. 3 out of the 5 games so far. But yeah, I think going into the what wound up being the abbreviated series in Philadelphia, I had been rather sarcastic in writing up that preview of that series, just, you know, talking about people getting to conclusions based on what had been transpiring over the last week or several weeks, really, at that point. I have major concerns, and we'll get to the most major of those in a few minutes, but I keep going back to it. When things are going poorly, you can fall back on the 2-wild-card format, kind of making it that you don't have to be the best team in baseball or even the best or second best team in your division to contend. And I don't know. I think there's enough that has gone poorly that it's not unrealistic to think this team can hang around 500. And if you hang around 500 and have one more run like they did, get right back into the mix for some form of postseason spot. So, I'm not looking to bet thousands of dollars on the Mets making the playoffs at this point. But I also don't think, it's impossible that it happens. I think I had said that much like the winning stretch to start the season was treated with skepticism, the extreme losing should be treated with skepticism. It's not a lot, but 2-2 against, the Phillies and Blue Jays, when both of those teams are, I'd say, legitimate wildcard contenders, at least. Obviously the Blue Jays have a tougher division to play in right now, but you know, it's not nothing. It's not emphatically, you know, hey, yes, they're back, they're awesome. But when you had things go the way they did, and DeGrom threw one inning, and he came out of both of those 2-2, you know, they've had worse times, some of them very recently.
Yeah, I guess I feel about the same as you guys. You know, it was that 12-2 game was a lot of fun. Obviously, I had to recap the 12-1 game that followed, which was considerably less fun. But that was also a case of, you know, and I'm not making an excuse for Zach Wheeler here, because there was that long delay when they were getting the field playable. He went something like a half hour without throwing a pitch, and came out of that just, you know, out of rhythm and not able to execute the way he was early in the game. And I'm not saying the Mets would have won that game if there wasn't that delay. I'm not saying that at all. But it's a mitigating factor in that game. So I don't feel so bad about that game, just because it sort of came about through, you know, unusual circumstances. I think that what Chris said, there's a lot of wisdom in that. In that, you know, another, if they can stick around 500 and go on another, you know, 10-1 or 11-2, whatever run later in the season, that puts them in wildcard contention. What gives me hope about that is that no real offensive player, and I said this last week, I believe, no offensive player aside from Cabrera has really caught fire yet. And you have to believe that one or two of their pieces will catch fire in the next few weeks. I guess I should put Nimmo in that category too. He doesn't play a lot, but whatever he does, you know, he's doing quite well. So if you think, you know, if Bruce or Cespedes or Conforto gets hot for a couple of weeks and carries the team a little bit, well, that makes me feel a whole lot better about the way things stand. I'm still very worried about the starting pitching, but I think that I'm not quite out of hope yet, but I will say that there have been five or six games in the last month that the team has looked as bad as any Mets team I can remember in recent memory. And that is really alarming.
Yeah, I think that Chris is right in the sense that I could very easily see this team just going 500 until July. And then, like, they're sticking around, you know, and for them to play somewhat meaningful games down the stretch. But my biggest concern is that, you know, a similar thing happened in 2015, right? And this is looking kind of a lot like the 2015 Mets, except there's no Cespedes coming, and there's no get all our guys back from the disabled list coming. And that's my biggest concern, is that, like, 2015, the roster at the end looked completely different than the roster during the first half when they were struggling. And we're not making a trade like that again, because we don't have the pieces to make a trade like that again. And so it's just like, I love the idea of sticking around to be able to make a push, but it's like, where is that extra oomph gonna come from? I just don't see it. And in 2015, there was only really one team in the division that was better than us that happened to collapse while we were climbing the ladder. Whereas this year, there are probably three teams in the division that are just as good as, if not better than we are.
Yeah, I will say that I think that the Phillies are probably playing a bit above what they're going to be playing at the rest of the season right now. But again, I wouldn't be shocked if they are a better team than folks thought. I will just say this, say this about 2015 though. I think it's easy to look back on 2015 and talk about how Cespedes came in and saved the day, and in so many ways he did. But we didn't see that trade coming earlier in the season either. It wasn't like that was a foregone conclusion. So, are there players out there that could help the Mets? Absolutely. Are there players out there who could help the Mets in July? Absolutely. But like you said, Allison, I don't know if we have the pieces necessarily to get one of those impact players. But I also don't know if this team is going to require a player as impactful as Cespedes, you know, or if there will be more minor upgrades that can be made in July and maybe even in August that will fill some of those, you know, spots in the Mets that are small enough upgrades that we don't need the big package to land somebody.
Yeah.
Because right now we just need a fifth starter. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know,
if you want
fifth starter is fine.
If you want to know where the tone has gone as we're recording, the one of the folks from the Daily News tweeted out the back page tomorrow, and they photoshopped DeGrom and Syndergaard into Yankees jerseys.
Oh, God.
For the full back page saying, can you deal? Mets might need to face facts and trade DeGrom or Thor, and Yankees are an ideal partner. Like, no.
Nope.
Oh, my God. I think I just threw up in my mouth.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's I think that's a good indication of how off the rails the conversation has gone.
Yeah, it's kind of bad.
Yeah. But we can talk about the rotation, I guess.
Yeah. Chris wrote something today about how the Mets have two aces and they still have a terrible rotation, and that's an astute point. So Chris, well, why don't you walk us through your general feeling about the rotation as it stands on May 17th?
Well, yeah, so sort of fitting into the overall theme here of, you know, finding things, whether they're internal or external, they get better. You know, Conforto is obviously a better hitter than this. If you have some concern because of the injury he had and, you know, the fact that he came back so quickly relative to what was expected and you know, what's the long-term effects of the injury and surgery, okay, fine. You know, that's warranted. But his performance itself, we know he's capable of more. Same goes for Jay Bruce, really. You know, I think Adrian Gonzalez has probably exceeded expectations, but not been, you know, phenomenal. He's been okay, you know, a little bit better than league average as a hitter. You know, like a good week or two away from being Duda-ish overall with the bat, which is not an insult. I think we've established how much we appreciated Lucas Duda in his time with the Mets. But, yeah. That stuff seems to me like it's pretty easy to explain, you know, hey, Bruce, Conforto are probably better hitters than this. Even Cespedes is probably a better overall hitter. You know, he had that long stretch where he was driving in a lot of runs, but the line is a little lower than he would like. You know, we know what he's capable of as long as he's on the field. The rotation is the thing that concerns me the most because it's, you know, part of this is stuff that I wrote, and I think some of it is stuff that, not that I didn't think it, but I think folks had pointed out, you know, in the comments. You have Syndergaard and DeGrom, or DeGrom and Syndergaard if you want to rank them, you know, in the order that everybody perceives them in right now, and they've thrown 47% of the innings of the starting pitchers. Now, part of that has been ineffectiveness. You know, it's not just that, oh, they're starting these two guys every third day and nobody else is pitching. Part of it's just that they've lasted longer in games than the other guys. But they've thrown a disproportionate number of innings, and yet the rotation ranks 20th in baseball in ERA. And Syndergaard's been good despite people somehow thinking he's not anymore for some reason. And then, you know, DeGrom has been just phenomenal. I just don't know, you know, where does it come from? And getting back to the point that people were making, I think in the comments, was even if Matt and Wheeler become a little more, you know, good more often than bad, nobody thinks that either one of them is going to throw, you know, 200 innings. I mean, most people would probably take the under if you said it way lower than 200 innings.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that, you know, one, do Wheeler, Mads, Vargas get better to a point that, you know, you can win more of the games that they start than they currently are? And then two, even if they do, how long do they last? So the spot I go for the answer is probably Flexen, Oswalt, whomever comes up and, you know, didn't have a whole ton of prospect hype, but comes up and just is good at the major league level.
Pulls it a Grom.
Yeah, and even Harvey was, you know, he was a prospect. He wasn't like a nobody, but he wasn't considered to be a better prospect than Wheeler when he came up. You know, so Harvey and DeGrom come up and are, you know, ace level pitchers right away. The Mets don't necessarily need that, but they need, you know, that legitimate number three type starter performance from somebody, whether it's Lugo, Gesellman, who are, you know, transitioned from the bullpen back into starting, or one of those minor league guys. So I don't know. Do either of you have any solutions? Yeah, Allison mentioned earlier, you know, the sort of the weird situation they're in terms of acquiring somebody. I don't know if they have something to get a pitcher who makes a major difference. Maybe it will be proven wrong, but any solutions out there that give you hope?
I mean, I am of the pretty strong opinion that Seth Lugo should be in the rotation, like, yesterday. I mean, just through the fact that he pretty much earned it out of spring training, and then they got sufficient off days such that they didn't need to use the fifth starter for a while, and then by the time they didn't need to use it, they were like, oh, Zach Wheeler, we're going to call him up, and he's going to be fine. And, I mean, early on, he was fine. And I'm not saying they should replace Wheeler with Lugo necessarily. I'm saying that they should give Vargas one, maybe two more starts. And if he continues like this, they can't keep putting him out there. And they should switch Lugo into the rotation. I think that he's earned it at this point. And I think that of the two, meaning Lugo and Gesellman, the two converted starting pitchers to relief pitchers, I think Lugo is more likely to be successful converting back to a starting pitcher. And I say that because both Lugo and Gesellman have benefited from increased velocity on their pitches because they're throwing shorter stints at a time. And I think Gesellman benefits more from that because he's more reliant on his fastball than Seth Lugo, who's plus pitches his curveball. So I think that Seth Lugo transitioning back to the rotation could potentially help the team. And they don't have to keep him there, you know, if he comes back and he doesn't do well, they can put him back in the bullpen and then call up a Flexen or an Oswalt for that spot. But I think the first solution should be Seth Lugo. That's just my opinion.
I mean, I don't disagree with that opinion necessarily. Lugo scares me because of the partial tear.
Yeah, he's a ticking time bomb.
And it seems like I'm sure there's no difference in terms of danger throwing out of the bullpen versus the starting rotation in terms of what's more likely to pop that ligament completely apart as opposed to just a partial tear. But it just feels like it's somehow more dangerous than him in the rotation. Whereas, and also Gesellman has more success from the rotation than Lugo does. Mm-hmm. Although the pop in velocity is certainly a beneficial thing for Gesellman out of the bullpen. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think at this point you have to look at it that the Mets have a number three starter somewhere between Lugo, Gesellman, Wheeler, Mats, and Vargas. One of them is going to have to be good enough to be their number three starter going forward for the rest of the year. So if you're looking to trade for somebody, you're not looking to necessarily go for, again, I said this before, you know, an ace. You're looking for somebody who can fill out the back end of the rotation. And I think the Mets probably have the prospects or the sort of mid-level major leaguers to flip for a number four, number five starter in July. Will that set their world on fire? No, but shoring up the back end of the rotation to me is a severely needed thing right now. It's really frustrating to watch a Mets game that isn't started by DeGrom or Syndergaard right now because you just have no idea what you're going to get.
Yeah. And I think the real problem with Vargas has been, I mean, not only has he been completely ineffective, it's just that he was supposed to be the innings eater.
Right.
And because he's been so bad, he's pitching three innings at a time. And that's the really, really big problem, is that it's taxing on the bullpen, who is already sort of taxed to begin with. The problem, I mean, okay, obviously he's been completely awful, but even if he were slightly less awful, even if he just, you know, even if he gave up like five runs a game or whatever, if he threw seven innings every time, then that would almost be fine. But the fact that he's just like getting shellacked and then having to leave in the third inning every time, that's the really big issue. We don't have any innings eaters besides DeGrom, really. Because even Syndergaard, despite the fact that he's been good, and I have no I have no complaints about Syndergaard, but he hasn't gone deep into games this year so much. DeGrom's really the only one that's gone deep into games out of everyone.
Yeah, the thing that sparked all of that, you know, just writing something about the rotation was tweeting last night that, you know, sarcastically, I was thrilled that the Mets hadn't even given Bartolo a chance on a minor league deal when now he would be the third best pitcher on the team. Yeah, by like easily.
People got really mad at you for that.
They did, and I was like, "What's
people
the,
were
why?
Very mad online."
I was like, "I thought we already, I thought we all agreed on very few things, but one of them was that we love Bartolo." And
this
like,
podcast, I have advocated for not only bringing in Bartolo but also R.A. Dickey,
who maybe yeah, could be convinced to come out of retirement. That I should have brought that up as my you know, solution tonight. Hey, RA, we have some money. Well, maybe that's...
No, we don't.
Maybe that's the
issue.
We have
some Star Wars bobbleheads. We know you love Star Wars, RA. Come on out and pitch for us.
Yeah, but yeah, no, I was just like a little taken aback by the... you know, plenty of people agree, but the vitriol that comes your way saying, like, the Mets should have brought Bartolo Colon to spring training on a deal that cost them nothing. Like, yeah. Oh, he was old and bad. Oh, thanks, everybody. I didn't have Baseball Reference in front of me for the last, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever it's been.
Didn't stop them from bringing Adrian Gonzalez in for nothing, and he was old and bad.
Or yeah, Jason Vargas, who's never been good and is old.
Yes. And yeah, so all of that. So I was just like, okay, I'm not going to write specifically about that, but I am just going to sit down and remind everybody that the Mets front office thought the rotation was fine, did the bare minimum. Oh, we Jason Vargas for 2 years for some reason.
$16 million.
I'd rather one. I know this doesn't make sense, but like I'd rather 112 than 216 with him, just because. Yeah. Like, I'm already envisioning, I mean, if he doesn't get it together, then they can't do this. But I'm already envisioning the winter of like, well, Manny Machado's a great player, but we have Todd Frazier at third base. And I don't know who the free agent pitchers even are, but free agent pitcher A is, you know, he's nice, but we have Jason Vargas. Yeah, I'm building that. That's where I'm setting my expectations, not to get too far ahead of ourselves here in the season that can go a million different ways, but
yeah.
Anyway, I don't know why people hate the concept of bringing back Bartolo when everybody else who sucked last year was kept around and nobody complained about that.
Yeah. I'm mad about...
Sorry, go ahead, Allison.
I'm mad about my guy that I really wanted was Chacin, and he signed for like the same amount of money as Vargas, and he's fine, and I'm really mad about that. I know that like there was no way of predicting because there's other guys that people wanted like Alex Cobb and Lance Lynn and they've both been dreadful. So it's kind of just like, you know, I just got lucky. I'm not going to pretend that I knew Chacin would be better than these other choices, but that's the guy I really wanted for some reason. I was like hung up on it. I was like, I think Chacin would be perfect. And he has like a 3.6 ERA. And I'm like, God damn it.
And in defense of Cobb and Lynn, I think not having spring training has been shown to be a significant
a problem.
Issue. Cobb sure, has yeah, kind of he's turned a corner. I think he's got three starts now in a row that were good, good yep. to great. Lynn has not turned that corner yet.
I cut him from my fantasy team yesterday. Finally, I was like, oh, I gotta cut bait. I can't keep doing this.
Yeah, I think I'm just about there as well. Because I came in, I'm like, all right, this is good. But there was some stuff about him last year that may have indicated that he wasn't going to be quite as good as he used to be, you know, going forward. But I'll still, yeah. Fantasy-wise, right move. Real life, I'm still curious to see how it plays out. You know, with yeah. a guy who didn't have spring training in the conventional sense. It's, yeah. So yeah, that's the worst part is that if you have an extreme defender of the Mets front office, and like I think I'm pretty, it takes a good amount for me to get very critical. So if I'm calling somebody an extreme defender of the team, I think that's saying something. But you know, if you have somebody who's coming at it from that stance, they love to be like, oh, well, Cobb and Lynn suck and you all wanted them. You know, that's not really the point. One, they could easily both end up being better, right, than you know, Vargas or Wheeler or Mats. But you know, we have a decent amount of information in front of us, but you know, why was it when Bartolo, I forget who the other player was, but some other player went on the record and said, oh yeah, Bartolo told me he'd go back to the Mets on a minor league deal. And the Mets were like, publicly like, nah.
Ugh.
Like, we don't have an army of scouts or, you know, servers that only do baseball, you know, the game, not the office, but like the baseball analytical stuff. We don't have any of that. And, you know, we sentimentally may have wanted Bartolo back and said, hey, you never know. But what was there preventing, you know, front office from doing something that had no risk? You know, was it just, did they write him off the same way that people are like, oh, well, he was old and bad, so that's it. He was old and bad when he was like 36 or 7 or whatever it was, you know?
Yeah, they kept Jose Reyes, who was old and bad, for mentorship purposes. It's like Bartolo couldn't have done that for the pitchers. He's like a second pitching coach.
And you know, I'm not looking back, and I wanted him back, and it's, you know, not looking back now and saying, oh, they should have signed him for like Jason Vargas's contract. No. If he came and was like, I'll come into spring training and then you only have to pay me if I end up, you know, making the big league team, I just don't understand why they didn't give him a chance. And hey, from here on out the rest of the season, he could have a 7 ERA. But, you know.
Yeah, who knows?
It's just an example of, you know, not giving yourself options and pretending that there was depth that anybody could see it wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, one of the nice things about that 12-2 route against the Blue Jays was that Ahmed Rosario had a really nice game, and he seems to be coming around a little bit offensively. Allison, you just wrote up a nice big piece about him today. Tell us, what's your overall impression of Rosario at the quarter season mark?
So I think that there's been, and I kind of wrote the piece in reaction to just like a lot of what I've seen around, like somewhat in the Mason Avenue comments, but more so on like Mets Twitter about like Ahmed Rosario being a bust, and you know, he was completely overhyped and he's been disappointing and all these things. And I just felt like it was way too much to lay on the guy who's only played 83 games in the big leagues. So I decided to take a deeper dive into, you know, how he's performed so far. And those who expected him to come up and be immediately Carlos Correa level awesome were going to be disappointed. But, you know, I think that he has proven that his defense is, you know, as advertised. He's been a great defensive player. He's made a couple of miscues, but I think that that's been more of, you know, an adjustment to playing at big league level pace rather than, you know, actual shortage when it comes to him not being ready or his development or whatever. He goes really, really, really far to his left, and his plays up the middle have been fantastic. So I think his defense is, you know, hard to argue he hasn't been an upgrade over what we've seen at shortstop for the past many years, since like young Jose Reyes, basically. He's been
shortstop,
our best defensive
Wilmer Flores.
Yeah, right. Ruben Tejada, all the variations of shortstops that we've had that have been slower than you would think they'd be. Ahmed Rosario has been a really nice breath of fresh air to watch defensively. With the bat, we knew that his plate discipline was a problem, and that was obviously the biggest part of his development that's still lacking, and that has played out at the major league level. He strikes out too much. He doesn't walk enough. He's only walked like 4 times this whole season. And he hasn't walked at all in the month of May, 0 times. But there are reasons to be optimistic about him. And you alluded to the game in Toronto where he seems to have finally broken out. And that's not, it's not just that game. He's been hot with the bat for a good 10 days now. And his, even though he's not walking enough still, his chase rate is down from what it was last season. So therefore his contact percentage is up. So he's actually striking out less. He's not walking anymore, but he's making more contact. And he's making more hard contact. His hard contact percentage is up, and his exit velocity is up. So even though we still wish, I think the biggest gap in his game still is taking more pitches and taking more walks, but I can be encouraged by the fact that he's making more quality contact of the baseball. And that's playing out in the past couple of weeks. He's hitting like 397 or something like that. And he narrowly missed his first home run of the year in that Toronto game. He had a double that hit the orange stripe at the top of the fence that they had to review and decide it was not home run. So I think that there's a lot to be encouraged by Ahmed Rosario. And I think that, you know, he was called up really early and didn't spend too much time at AAA. He's just 22 years old. And I think Mets fans need to chill out a little bit about Ahmed Rosario and just, you know, let him, you know, figure it out. And the Mets show no indication that they're going to bench him or, you know, other than the occasional benching for Jose Reyes inexplicably. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. They're going to let him continue to start, continue to get the at-bats, figure it out at the big league level, which I think is the right thing to do. I don't think he has really much left to learn in Vegas. I know that people are saying his development is incomplete, but Vegas is really a shit place to learn a lot of things. Because you can't really trust the hitting stats that come out of there. As far as infield defense, it's terrible because it's basically like concrete out in the desert, like learning to play infield defense on concrete. So I really think that, you know, the Mets are actually doing the right thing with Ahmed Rosario and letting him play. And, you know, sometimes letting the young kids play is the better move rather than like plugging holes with a bunch of washed up old guys. Shocker.
I can't imagine being a Mets fan who looks at this team and decides that the problem I have that I have to speak out about is Rosario.
Right.
That seems absurd to me.
Right. And the one thing that I forgot to mention is he's actually been super successful out of the 9 hole. So he's had the vast majority of his at-bats in the 9th spot this season. And actually if you, and I'm not one to, you know, this is obviously all small sample size, and it's hard to draw any hard conclusions on it. But if you remove his at-bats out of places not in the 9 hole this season, he actually has a 94 WRC+, which is a perfectly acceptable number for a defense first shortstop.
So. I can't argue with any of that, Chris. Can you?
No. And, I'm on board with that, and I still, you know, kind of stand by thinking that he can be a really great player. You know, and as Allison, you know, mentions in the piece, you have a guy come up at a time that, you know, all these superstar shortstops came up and just hit the ground running. And sometimes I hate to go back to this thought because I'm not, you're never saying that the guy you're talking about is going to be this guy. But the fact that Mike Trout came up, nobody's going to be Mike Trout. That's certainly not the point.
You're not. Chris is saying Ahmed Rosario is Mike Trout, confirmed.
Mike Trout, but he can play shortstop, yes.
Trout for Rosario, who says no?
Yeah. But, that's an example that it maybe is the best example that no matter how good a guy ends up being, it's possible that he struggles when he first comes up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I talk about, like, even if you don't want to compare him to these superstar shortstops, fine, throw that away. Don't compare him to Correa and Lindor and those guys. Just, you don't have to look further than your own team. Think about young Jose Reyes.
I was just going to say that.
In 2004. He looked pretty much exactly like the type of guy that Ahmed Rosario looks like now, except maybe with more stolen bases. That's about it. He had about a 70, 80 WRC+. He was striking out a ton, And, you know, he hadn't figured it out yet because he was a young player, very young when Jose Reyes came up. How old was he when he came up? Young. Like,
20. I was, he was 20, maybe?
20? Yeah, so even younger than Rosario is now. And so, you know, I feel like, and we all know the player that Jose Reyes became. And in 2005, he started to come out a little bit. And then, like, finally, in 2005, I think he put up 1.7 FOR. And then in 2006, it was his, like, was his first big season. He had, like, over five. He was worth over five WAR. So if you think about, like, just being patient with Ahmed Rosario this season, I'm not saying he'll immediately put up five WAR next season, but, you know, being patient has its virtues. And I think that if we look at the career arc of Jose Reyes, I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation for someone like Ahmed Rosario.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of that. I think you're spot on. Rosario has been one of the few consistent bright spots defensively for the team this year. And it would be nice to have him hit a little bit more, and, you know, I'm rooting for that. But ultimately, if he's a defense-first shortstop and he's not an embarrassment out there, then that's fine by me.
Yep. You don't have to put up huge offensive numbers at shortstop if you play good defense to be valuable. Exhibit A, Andrelton Simmons. He was never, like, a star with the bat, but he put up extremely valuable numbers. Like, he was worth a lot because he played great defense. And, I mean, I'm not saying that Ahmed Rosario is not going to put up good numbers with the bat. I think he could. But I'm saying that he doesn't need to be as good with the bat as Correa, Lindor, or Seager to be valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, you guys ready to have some fun?
Sure.
I've been having fun.
Oh, well, let's turn the fun up a notch then. We had an email from our friend Fleshtown Fandom, and he has a series of would-you-rathers for us. So,
yay!
Would you guys rather, A, have an unlimited wardrobe of Mets/7-line gear, or B, a wicked cool memorabilia collection rivaling the Mets Museum at Citi Field? I'm going B every single time.
Allison, I'll let you. Yeah, you can go next.
Okay, I'm actually going with the wardrobe because I think that Fleshtown probably predicted that I would say that because I'm like that person that has 1,000 Mets shirts, so I'm kind of already there with that. And really, the only memorabilia I have is like bobbleheads, so I think it's clear where my priorities are.
Yeah, I would join Brian with the second option. I don't have a house. I don't have any desire to have a house. But in this hypothetical situation, I might be convinced to have one if I could have a World Series trophy and some gold gloves and, you know, things of that nature, to use Sandy Alderson's one of his go-to phrases. So
I would love to have, I'm sure you've both been in the Mets Hall of Fame Museum. I would love to have that original creepy Mr. Met head.
And just, oh my gosh.
Just leave it in my window to fuck with the neighborhood kids. You know, that would be funny. Yeah, so that's where I go. All right, second question. Would you rather spend a weekend binge-watching Friends with Wilmer Flores or enjoy a private luxury box at Citi Field for one game with close friends and family? Chris, start us off.
The weekend with Flores watching Friends, and I've seen a lot of Friends. I'm certainly not like a diehard Friends fan, but that is, like, I think you could probably knock out the whole series if you really pushed the limits of how much you sleep. And I think that would just be a cool experience, and I can go to a game at Citi Field with close friends and family anytime, and we don't need a luxury box to enjoy it, so. Yeah.
I think I'm with you, Chris. I think I will take the watching Friends with Flores. And this was actually a tough decision for me because I really don't like Friends. But I really, really like Wilmer Flores. So, and like you said, I think it's like the Flores, meeting, getting to meet Flores. And hanging out with him and doing an activity he enjoys is like a once in a lifetime. Whereas going to City Field, even though the luxury box sounds nice, going to City Field with friends and family is a thing that I can theoretically do anytime, even though it's not so much anytime anymore now that I don't live that close to it, which made the decision even harder because now it's like not an easy thing for me to do. But I think I'll still pick Flores because that's like a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah, and I have friends who can, you know, quote every line of The Simpsons. I'm pretty close to that with Seinfeld. I'm ashamed that I'm not more on top of my game with The Simpsons lines. But I'd love to be there and just hear Wilmer Flores out of nowhere just start, you know, talking and quoting as the episode is going on with random lines. I think that
That'd
would be
so awesome.
Yeah. Sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
That's right. Here's my fear with watching it with Flores. You know when you have a friend who's like, oh, you got to watch this movie, it's the best, and they spend the whole 2 hours looking at you to make sure that you're enjoying yourself while watching.
And then you feel
like
the pressure.
Yes. And I hate friends. Like, I really don't think it's funny. And I feel like it would be 2 days of Wilmer just waiting for me to laugh and enjoy it. And I would feel such pressure to do so that I could never perform under that that amount of stress. So it would just be a very awkward 2 days with Wilmer Flores. So I think I'm going with the luxury box.
Disappointing. Wilmer Flores does sound like a huge bummer. I never want to disappoint Wilmer
exactly.
Flores. I'd probably just pretend that I'm really happy that I'm watching Friends.
I'm not that good of an actor. I couldn't do it.
I'm not that great of an actress, but like, I don't know. I think I'd be so happy that I was with Wilmer Flores that I wouldn't care what I was doing. That I would like, I would enjoy Friends even though I don't like it just because his energy is super infectious. And I'd be like, yeah, this is super great because it's with Wilmer Flores. Whereas if I watched it with like anybody else or by myself, I'd be like, this is crap.
See, I'll shift the question a little bit. If we can like go to the Central Perk pop-up that was in the city and, you know, go to a Rembrandt's concert and, you know, do Friends things, then I'm all for that. But if it's just sitting around watching Friends, I'm not so into it.
Fair.
All right. Would you rather David Wright finally come back, finish out his contract in 2008 form, and gracefully retire, or sign Manny Machado to a 7-year deal this offseason?
Oh my god.
This is the hardest one for me.
Yep, it is.
That just physically, like, I just felt physical pain inside me thinking about having to make that choice. Someone else has to go first. I'm not going first.
All right, so I'll take David Wright. Shocker, I know. but if he comes back, you know, tomorrow, and he's 2008 good, this team's going to the playoffs, and he can probably be a part of a team. You never know in the playoffs, but he could probably be part of a team that, you know, wins a World Series, he retires, and then I don't care. If that happens, the Mets can suck for 10, 20, or 30 years. If David Wright is part of a team that wins it all, I know I'm drawing an extra conclusion here, but he was that good if you add him to the mix. So screw it. I'll take it. And even in a fantasy world, I can't imagine the Mets actually signing Machado. So there you go.
Yeah, I think I have to choose right here just because, you know, Chris and I think are about the same age. I feel like for guys of our generation, Wright was our Met and represented all the hopes and dreams of being a Mets fan. And his story is ending just so sadly that it's such a huge bummer for him to make a comeback, and not only to come back and be a part of the team, but be a vital, integral part of the team. Not only does that make the on-field product so much better, it just is such a great story. And, I mean, I'm a guy who's prone to crying to begin with. I'm an emotional guy. But, like, David Wright, like, throwing out the final out of the World Series after coming back from spinal stenosis. I mean, I can get misty thinking about that right now. You know, I have to go with David Wright.
Yeah, I'm picking David Wright, too. I can't forsake David Wright. I mean, and I know, like, everyone knows that, like, Manny Machado is my dream. Like, my dream. I live in Baltimore, so I watch Manny Machado play on the regular, and he's, like, by far my favorite non-Mets player. And so, like, the idea of turning down a contract with Manny Machado, like, kills me inside. But David Wright's my favorite baseball player ever. So that kind of trumps that. So just to have him back for one more season like you said, Brian, like just thinking about David Wright, like coming back from this and actually being good again, even if it's just for one more season, like makes me so emotional just thinking about it. Even if they don't make the World Series because of it, like just, you know, a few more David Wright, a few more precious David Wright memories in that old memory bank would be priceless.
Yeah. All right. Would you rather be the 26th person, I'm being gender neutral here because Allison, you have to play this one too, be the 26th person on the Mets roster making the league minimum for 3 pre-arb seasons, or have a front office job with actual responsibilities where job security is linked to your individual performance? And then he makes a note here that a starting salary in the front office is about $145,000 a year.
So, did he mean 25th man on the roster? Because if I only get to play in, like, unscheduled doubleheaders, or whatever that technicality is, then I'm not taking that. But if he meant 25th man...
I mean, I think he might mean, like, somebody who's on the bubble, who comes up a couple of times throughout the year. You know, you're Phil Evans.
Okay, if that's the rule, then I'll take the front office job. But... If it was, you know, last guy on the roster who everybody else hates because he's terrible, I'd still take that because I'm playing baseball. Yeah, I picked both. I'm sorry. With the rules that you established, I'll take the front office job.
Yeah, I was full on being the player, but then like you said, you're Phil Evans, and I thought about like the fact that I'd have to like shuttle back and forth between Vegas and spend lots of my time being like living minor league life, which sounds terrible. I mean, I know I'd be making so like my understanding is that Phil Evans like because like how many does he make league minimum this year because he played on the Mets a couple times?
Well,
you make
your major league salary on a prorated basis for the time you're with the major league team, but being on the 40 gets you out of minor league salary purgatory. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's higher than normal minor leaguer. And it's, I think obviously presumably, lower than,
right.
You know, the major league minimum, but yeah, I think if you're on the 40, you're not loaded, but you're doing okay. I think that's the impression I get. So,
yeah, I think that like because like the idea of being the 26th man, where I'd have to go back and forth between the minors and the majors, and that sounds like exhausting and terrible. I think I'd pick the front office job. But like Chris said, I agree with Chris. If I was on the team all year, even if it was just like getting like my one at bat per week and striking out as a pinch hitter and having everybody boo me, I'd pick that.
I go with being the player for 3 reasons. Number one, I'm a practical kind of guy, and I would get health insurance for life because I played an inning in the major leagues. And yeah. So just for the healthcare benefits, I'm in. Number two, I would probably get a baseball card out of it, like a professional baseball card that people can trade and do whatever with and that I can give to my children and grandchildren. That is number two. Number three, I think... I can't imagine how much, how many ridiculous things I would see in a year of playing baseball. How many, you know, not only just great baseball moments, but how many great, like, pseudo-celebrity moments. It would be a really fun, fascinating couple of years. So, yeah. Although, you know, downsides, I'd miss my family. You know, Vegas sucks, etc. But I think I'd be the player. All right, we have a few more of these. We have 4 more of these. Would you rather have John Kruk and John Buck replace Gary Keith and Ron, Joe Buck rather, replace Gary Keith and Ron, or have the Mets and Yankees trade broadcast teams? Note, in the second scenario, you can still listen to Gary Keith and Ron call Yankees games.
I don't want the Yankees to have our guys, so the other one.
Oh, I couldn't do Kruk and Buck.
Well, no, I didn't say I could do them. Could you do Michael Kay and Sterling?
More than I could do Kruk and Buck, yes.
Oh, man.
I hate
but,
Joe
but there's the other aspect of I don't want Yankee
every part of me hates Joe Buck.
I just don't want Yankee fans to have something great in the booth.
Yeah, I'm with Chris. The Yankees don't deserve Gary, Keith, and Ron. I'm not letting them have them. So I'll pick the – I agree with you, Ryan, that it's the crappier of the two broadcast options for us. But then I'm just going to listen to Howie and Josh all the time.
Oh, yeah. Is it only TV teams? Because then I'll – yeah. We need more rules, Flush Town.
More rules.
Next all time right. we need multiple addenda to each question. Okay. Would you rather
section A.
Yes. All right. Would you rather make out with Fred Wilpon for 45 seconds once or have Jeff Wilpon magically appear whenever you're assembling / installing things at home so he can berate and belittle you?
Who's not taking the second one?
Me.
What?
45 seconds of misery is way better than having Jeff Wilpon in my house for any reason.
But that would be amazing.
No, it wouldn't.
Yes, it would.
Why? Tell me why.
Because imagine him berating you.
I'm crying.
I don't want to be berated by Joe Bluth. Like it seems so horrible to have Jeff Wilpon in my house.
Well, no, Joe would be hurtful. Jeff Wilpon would be like, oh, that happened.
You don't think he'd be very intimidating?
No.
Oh, I guess I have to be the tie-breaking vote on this. I'm definitely picking Jeff Wilpon berating me. I don't, because A, the thought of making out with Fred Wilpon's disgusting, and B, I don't assemble things, like, barely ever, so I think that this would be, like, a rare occurrence. So this goes back to Fleshtown needing to give us more rules, because to get around it, I would just make other people assemble things for me. Does that like induce the Jeff Wilpon appearing, or does it have to be me?
I think you guys are overestimating how bad a 45-second encounter can be. But that's just
no. Me. I think you're underestimating how amazing it could be. Like, no, Jeff, you're wrong. I know how to install this shelf.
If Jeff Wilpon appeared in my house periodically, I'd get to yell at him about Met shit. I'd get to yell back at him.
See,
and I'd get to take out my frustration of years and years of him running this team and me being pissed off about it.
See, I don't like my children, who actually love me, watch me do stuff around the house because I get embarrassed if I mess something up. So it's just going to be even worse when there's this sycophant millionaire hanging out in my house telling me I'm using the wrong Allen wrench or something. No, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do it.
I'm not sure that he even knows what an Allen wrench is.
No, but he knows I'm using the wrong one because he knows everything because he's Jeff Wilpon.
I am surprised. when I look down the list, I'm like, all right, there's one that's going to be unanimous. Nope.
I'm really glad that we had this one because it was funny.
I think the next one might be unanimous.
Okay.
You and two of your friends of your choosing get in a bar fight with Bryce Harper and Anthony Rendon, or compete in a televised boxing match against Omar Minaya.
So, I'm going to say fight Harper and Rendon in a bar. One, I don't want to fight Omar Minaya. And two, Omar Minaya would probably knock me out. Bar fight, there's other objects available. It's a 3-on-2 situation. I get to pick any two of my friends. One of them is very large. Actually, two of them are very large. So I feel like we'd have a standing chance. You know, there's a little more at play there. And also, you know, I like Bryce Harper, but has anybody had a more like punchable face than Bryce Harper?
No.
Yeah.
I take him on my team in a heartbeat, but also same. I would understand I kind of get where Papelbon was coming from.
I would choose the bar fight just for, I would make him throw a punch and I would dodge it. And then I'd say, that's a clown punch, bro. And then I punch him in the face. Just to use that line would be worth it for me.
I would also fight Harper, but I wouldn't, but because I don't think I would ever punch anyone in the face. I can't envision a single scenario unless I was like literally defending myself against like someone punching me where I would punch someone.
Okay,
but
imagine the scenario. You're trying to install your cable box, and Jeff Wilpon appears behind you.
But I would, of the two, because they both involve fighting someone, I would much rather punch Bryce Harper than Omar Minaya, so I'll go with that one. Because Bryce Harper does indeed have the most punchable face of all time.
All right. Last one. Would you rather all baseball bench clearing brawls escalate into a giant tickle match, or all baseball grievances are aired out in a professional wrestling match on live television?
With the caveat that I only had professional wrestling phases when I was a child, I'd still rather the latter. Giant tickling match weirds me out a little bit. It's funny, but I don't need to see, like, Giancarlo Stanton tickle Chris Sale.
Have you guys seen that documentary, Tickled?
No.
So there's this documentary about how there's this competitive tickling, like underground tickling thing, and it's the creepiest thing you've ever seen in your whole life. And so I would certainly choose the professional wrestling match, just because there's also the element of professional wrestling where they'd have to, like, cut a promo on the other player. So you get to hear people be like, you know, Giancarlo Stanton, you hit a home run against my team. And just, like, have these, like, crazy over-the-top verbal battles before the wrestling match. So I think that'd be worth it.
The thought of those promos is pretty funny, because, like, if you think about, like, how, like, dumb and old school most baseball grievances are, hearing them in the over dramatized, like, deep voice is really funny. It's like, you threw a pitch somewhat near me.
You did not run out of ground ball. You will pay.
You wore your hat backwards. You're an asespidus. That offends me.
See?
But I'm still picking the tickling match. Sorry. That's hilarious. I'm less creeped out by it.
I have questions about the documentary.
Was that?
Was the documentary like a Christopher Guest thing?
No, it's real. It's real. And
okay.
The guy that like runs the underground tickling ring is like a reclusive millionaire who...
Oh my God.
Who basically funds these videos through like fake individuals that set up these shell personalities and shell bank accounts to funnel this money from a real estate business into this underground tickling thing. You should definitely watch it, Chris. It's super fucked up and great.
That's
all right.
Really, really bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm picking tickling, though, because did you see the one brawl that did end up being tickling? I think that was his inspiration for this one. What was it? It was like, I think it was the Cubs and the Pirates? I can't remember. There was a thing on Twitter that was a video of, like, the two teams who were, like, they were all out on the field, so it clearly had been, like, a benches-clearing situation, but, like, I guess not all of them wanted to fight each other, and then there were, like, a few guys that were tickling each other. And it was hilarious, and I was like, yeah, I want more of this, so I'm picking tickling.
Well, that certainly got some interesting opinions out there.
I like these. I want him to submit them every week.
Yeah, I could definitely do with more of these. These are fun.
He's really good at it. They're creative.
Yes, I agree. Just for a side note here, I want to make it clear that I would not be looking forward to making out with Jeff Wilpon. I mean, to Fred Wilpon, but I stand by my choice.
Fair. I want Jeff Wilpon to berate me while I assemble IKEA furniture. It's my dream.
I feel like he would be so ignorant as to what you're even doing.
I know. It would be funny, right? Because he wouldn't even know, like, how... Like, he doesn't even know what IKEA is. He has no concept of that. Yeah. So he'd be like, yeah, you're turning that tool wrong. And that's, like, the best insult he can come up with.
I still just don't want that cube in my house. That's what it comes down to.
That's fair.
Hey everybody, this is Steve Sleipa, and I'm back to go over our minor league players of the week. We just finished week 5, which is May 6th through May 12th, and the Las Vegas 51s went 3-4, and that puts them at 14-23 for the season, 8 games behind Salt Lake Bees for first place. Binghamton Rumble Ponies went 3-4, and they had a game postponed, and they are 16-17 for the year, which puts them 4.5 games behind the Trenton Thunder for first place. St. Lucie Mets went 3-3, and they also had a rain postponed game, and that leaves them at 15-19 for the year, which is 7 games behind the Jupiter Hammerheads. And finally, the Columbia Fireflies went 2-4, and they are the only minor league team to be over 500 with a 18-17 record, and that puts them 3 games behind the Augusta Green Jackets for first place. Now, our pitcher of the week for week 5 is Columbia Fireflies left-handed pitcher David Peterson. He made 1 start this week, and he pitched 7 scoreless innings, allowing 3 hits, walking 1, and striking out 8. So, like Marcel Renteria last week, this is by far the best start of Peterson's professional career. But, again, like we said last week with Renteria, he only has a couple of them under his belt right now. But for any pitcher, 7 innings of scoreless ball is pretty good. And right now, I'll be honest, I'm just happy that he's on the field. I've alluded to this a couple of times. You know, I knew he was hurt during spring training. I had reason to believe that he was hurt a little worse than the tweaked knee that the Mets said he was dealing with. But regardless, he has 4 starts under his belt now. His numbers are okay. The stuff doesn't seem to be diminished. So I guess all is well. If he was still dealing with physical issues, I think that there would be some kind of reflection of that somewhere, be it in his numbers, how his stuff looks, whatever. But there isn't, so I guess we're all in the clear. Now, when the season started, I know a lot of people were kind of surprised that Peterson was assigned to Columbia, but really, in the long run, it doesn't matter. Him pitching a half season in Columbia and then a half season in St. Lucie instead of pitching the entire season in St. Lucie, whatever. It's not like he's a factor in the Mets' plans for this year or for next, so it really doesn't matter. And you know what? There are talented hitters in the South Atlantic League, and there's talented hitters in the Florida State League, and the overall difference in talent isn't massive enough to really make a pronounced difference in his baseball development, especially for like 50 innings or so. So it doesn't really matter. And in his start this week, he really looked like he was toying with the hitters. You know, he was hitting all of his spots, he was using all of his pitches, everything was working. So if the Mets want him to get a little confident, get used to being, you know, get used to the life of a minor leaguer and whatever, spending a little time in Columbia is fine. Plus, with him down there, it gives us, by far, the best overall rotation in the Mets system right now. In addition to Peterson, the Columbia Fireflies also have Anthony Kay, they have Chris Vile, they have Tony DeBrell, Marcel Renteria, Joe Cavallaro, Jake Simon. The first two are obviously guys that are already on our top prospect lists. Those next two, Vile and DeBrell, they're guys that I've been very vocal and bullish about. And those last three, Renteria, Cavallaro, and Simon, they aren't guys to sleep on. Maybe they're not going to have the highest upsides, but all three could have situational value, be it reliever or back-end starter, whatever it is. Maybe not Cavallaro. Now, no offense to him, but of all of the guys listed, his ceiling is probably the lowest. Maybe Simon's is the lowest, but he's also a very different pitcher. You know, he's was a high school left-hander, so there's a lot of ways that his career could go, and he's still much further back in his development than Cavallaro is. But I digress now. On to our hitter of the week. This guy went 11 for 27 with 2 doubles, 2 triples, a homer, 8 RBI, 1 walk, and 10 strikeouts. And he is a throwback. And he is Binghamton right fielder Johan Urania. And I know it feels like Urania has been around forever, but he actually is only 23. He last appeared on a top prospect list here at Amazing Avenue in 2016, when he was ranked the Mets' 21st top prospect. In the 2015 list, the year before he was ranked even higher, he was named the Mets' 14th top prospect list. Now, what caused his fall from grace was not 1, but 2 broken hammy bones. He's a switch hitter. He hits from the left side and the right side. Both of those bones fractured. The hamate bone is a very small bone in the wrist. It's in the hand by the wrist. But despite its little size, it has a pretty big impact on players when it's damaged. Basically, when it is broken or damaged, bruised, whatever, it reduces the player's ability to kind of grip the bat. It causes pain in the wrist, and that causes pain when he swings. So it makes it harder to swing a bat, and it makes it harder to swing it with authority. Beyond the Box Score did a study a couple of years ago, and they concluded that the majority of players that have broken AMA bones do return to prior norms, but it takes roughly about a season to do so. So if you look at the numbers that Urania was putting up, it actually plays out just like they said it would. When he returned to the field in 2016, he did play a career-high 115 games, but he hit 225, 301, 350, which is pretty crappy, all things considered. In 2017, a little bit more time after the injury, he hit 282, 364, 437, and he hit a career-high 11 home runs. So you can see a very big difference in the numbers. One in the season immediately after the injury, and then one another year removed. And in addition to Urania being fully healthy, I think that he's in the best shape of his life. He's always been a kind of thick, stocky guy, but he has trimmed a little bit. Not massive, but he's trimmed down a little bit, and it is showing, I think. His bat speed, whether because of that injury or just some of the bad weight that he was starting to put on or whatever, but the bat speed looked like it was starting to slow down last year. And this year, the bat speed is looking a lot better. And then you combine that with the fact that he's gotten better against recognizing spin over the last couple of years and putting together better at-bats. And he actually might be able to fulfill some of those 50-hit tool grades that he was getting projected to have a couple of years ago. 50, you know, being major league average or so. And in addition, he's able to play the outfield now, which is kind of surprising. His destiny always seemed to be first base, again, because he was kind of a thick, stocky guy and had limited mobility. But he played a little bit of the outfield last season. He got reps there in the instructional league last season, and he's now Binghamton's primary right fielder. He isn't exactly natural. He's never going to be. But with John Mora out there and Champ Stewart out there in center field, at least his defensive shortcomings can kind of be mitigated a bit. He has a strong arm, and he could read the ball off the bat decently enough, so that's all you could ask of him, really. He sees the ball, he runs over to it, if he gets it, if not, not. And if need be, he has the arm to rocket the ball back into the infield. So, those are our players of the week, and check back in next week. We'll go over the Mets minor league players for week 6.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you for listening. We truly appreciate it. Go to AmazingAvenue.com where you can read wonderful pieces by the folks you heard tonight, as well as lots of other Amazing Avenue contributors. We're doing some really fun stuff lately. And, you know, when the season is a little bit rough like this, I think it's great to be reading a site that doesn't just focus on the day-to-day of the Major League team, but has a nice focus on the minors and kind of looks big picture at some stuff. And so I can't recommend AmazingAvenue.com enough. I'm proud to be a part of it. And, you can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find our show, this show you're listening to right now, at blogtalkradio.com, at Apple Podcasts, at Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. That helps us quite a bit. We are working on getting a new email address for the podcast. So for now, just, I guess, tweet at us. And I'm just now realizing we had someone tweet us a question and we forgot to answer it. So I promise next week we will get to that. My apologies. I believe that was, I forget who it was now. I should look it up. I'm sorry. We should have prepared for that better. But anyway, we are getting a new email address, so stay tuned for that. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. I am at Brian Intenap. Allison is at Petite PhD. Chris is at Chris McShane, and Steve is at Steve Saipa. So we got the Diamondbacks coming to town right now. They're ailing. Maybe we can knock out a couple of wins. That would be a nice thing. So we'll find out what happens next time we're all together on Amazing Avenue Audio. And so, until next time, let's go Mets.